Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna have a...
Too many things we found. That's the Solartopia song with the great Pete Seeger and David Burns. And, of course, Star Williams and me, Harvey Washman. I did Sluggo, you can call me. I did not sing gratefully, which is why we got it done in one tape. But I did write the word Solartopia. We're back for another Green Power and Wellness show, thanks to the crew in New York. We're going to be talking about election protection with some of our regular experts, leaders, amazing activists, people that I am really privileged to have on my show with me. John Brakey, you with us?
I certainly am. Harvey, how are you?
Hi, buddy. How are you? Steve Rosenfeld, you on yet?
Yep. Hi, how are you?
Steve, you're here. Do we have a third guest, John? Were you able to arrange that?
Susan, I think, is going to be jumping on, but I'm not sure. She, you know, she's just gone through that storm, and but she's going to try to join.
Yeah, okay.
He's
the one that Trump put in Alabama, and then he was going to drop the nuclear weapon on. Is that the storm?
It's pretty bizarre. Yes.
Our meteorologist in chief is going to start dropping nuclear weapons on hurricanes. This is good. They'll bring in the clowns, right? So we're going to talk about election protection stuff today. And Steve, you just apparently had a major impact in Iowa, which you want to talk about with the Democratic Party. And John, you are rolling away. We got the whole hour here to deal with the most important issue facing America, which is the integrity of the upcoming 2020 election. If, in fact, we have it, I'm not convinced that Trump isn't going to do something to try and cancel this thing. I mean, it's never in history have we had an election where the loser goes straight to jail. So Mr. Trump does, well, I never called president, by the way. He's not the president. He's not my president. He never elected. Has no business being in the White House. Where he should be is the big house. But that's another story. It is this story. Well, we're going to talk about this huge judicial victory in North Carolina. Talk about what the Democrats are doing in terms of their primaries, which was such a fiasco in 2016. But I want to jump right in real quickly before we lose track on what's going on in Ohio. Ohio is still a swing state, still a major stretch for a Democrat to win. But something has just happened in Ohio that could actually change the entire election, and it has to do with nuclear power. Now, you're reading in the last day or two, John and Steve, we both read that Ohio is purging a couple hundred thousand people from the voter rolls, like as we speak. Steve, have you followed that at all?
Only a little bit, not as much to really be authoritative.
Okay, and John, have you seen that?
Not really, not in Ohio, but I am following other places, and it is a serious problem. And yeah.
Okay, so being a long time Ohioan, that's Ahian, Ohio, especially under the Republicans, loves to purge the voter rolls.
Yep.
And they're just in the process of purging another 200,000. God knows what their rationale is, because they can, basically. And we'll see how that affects what happens. But we definitely know. Well, the difference this year, as opposed to previous years, is that this year people actually paid attention. And we know it's happened. I mean, in previous years, they just went ahead and did it. And the names were gone and people showed up to vote and their names weren't on the voter rolls and that was it. So this time, people actually noted that the Republican Secretary of State is purging the voter rolls in Ohio, 200,000 votes. About between 5 and 6 million people vote in Ohio, so that's a pretty substantial percentage, certainly enough to make a difference in a national election. I mean, in 2004, John Kerry walked away with 118,775 in the Bush column, and that was the decider. So 200,000 votes is enough to swing an election in Ohio, presidential election. And, of course, the place is gerrymandered. But what I want to bring up now, and this is a very, very big deal, and no one's talking about it nationally, but it's a huge story. And it takes a little telling. So, John and Steve, I appreciate your hanging on here, but this is stuff, of course, that you will need to know as well. So there are two nuclear power plants in Ohio, Davis-Bessie and Perry. Davis-Bessie is a little east of Toledo, and Perry is about 35 miles east of Cleveland, both on the lake. The mistakes by the lake. And Perry is the first nuclear power plant in the United States to be physically damaged by an earthquake. It happened in 1986, right around the time the Challenger was blowing up. There was a 5.0, and it damaged pipes and roads. It actually damaged the plant and took out a bunch of roads and bridges in the neighborhood, making it very clear that in case of an earthquake, there's no way that Perry could, the region around Perry, could ever be evacuated. And the plant, thank God, was not operating. How they expect people to operate in a control room in the middle of an earthquake is beyond me. I'd like to see the actual rehearsals that they do, which, of course, they don't at all. So the bottom line is that Perry and Davis-Bessie are both money, big money losers, and their company, their owner, First Energy of Akron, which we believe to be a mob operation, and certainly the mob is involved in constructing nuclear plants. We haven't seen a hard evidence that they're running them, but it would make sense. So they had set shutdown dates for both Perry and Davis-Bessie of 2020 and 2021. Then, and they've been trying for years, these guys are just complete crooks at First Energy. The top seven executives at First Energy are paid a total of around $25 million a year. The chief executive, Chuck Jones of First Energy, gets $9.5 million a year in compensation for the fabulous job he's done. Now, Davis-Bessie, I won't go into the detail, but we've covered it on this show many times, has almost blown up a couple times. They had one of the worst accidents in all of reactor history, the infamous hole in the head reactor accident where boric acid ate all the way through a major piece of equipment and only stopped by a sleeve. I mean, it's a miracle that we didn't have a Chernobyl at Davis-Bessie. So they're in bankruptcy, First Energy. They set a shutdown date for the two reactors, but then they got the brilliant idea to go to the legislature and to get a bailout. And long story short, they basically hired a bunch of guys to run in the Republican primaries. They primaried some incumbents, put a ton of money in there, got just enough votes in our incredibly gerrymandered Ohio legislature to get a bailout of $150 million a year. And this thing was bitterly contested. I mean, and I've been in Ohio politics a long time. It's the first time that I have seen the Ohio media come out on the progressive side of an issue. I mean, this bailout was just incredibly hated. And, you know, they got a couple of Democrats, and they got the union supportive, and they got $150 million a year. Now, Ohio does have a referendum. and a group that we cannot for the life of us figure out exactly who they are, but they're clearly getting a lot of oil and gas money, came in and has successfully put a ballot issue on the 2020 electoral picture here. And let's put it this way. They have to get 250,000 signatures. But these people seem to have a ton of money. And the this referendum is going to be supported, I would guess, by three-quarters of the state. I mean, they're asking people in Cincinnati to pay for two nuclear plants on the lake. I mean, 220 miles away. I mean, it's insane. And people hate it. You know, the polls, however, no matter how much they spend to defeat this, we will win. This is a ballot initiative that we are going to win. And, and it's a progressive issue. We actually have, this is a situation where we have all the environmental groups in the state of Ohio working together with the oil and gas industry, because the oil and gas people don't want these two nukes bailed out. And of course, we don't either. So it's a little uneasy, but we've already had two major gas projects of many, many hundred, $200-400 million worth of gas projects that have been canceled because of this bailout. So here you have a situation going into the 2020 election. And by the way, Trump personally intervened in the bailout. He had one of his known henchmen call five state reps and senators to vote for the bailout. So this is very, very strongly identified with the Republicans, even though there were some Republicans who voted against it. You do still have some remnant dinosaur free market Republicans. And they were very strongly against this thing. And then, of course, you had the usual corporate Democrats sell us out and stab us in the back. So we have this now on the ballot in Ohio in 2020. As I say, technically, they don't yet have to have the signatures. I think their deadline is October 14th. But I don't have any doubt that this will get the necessary signatures and get on the ballot. And I want to tell you, you guys, John and Steve and my listeners, have seen many, many, many bizarre things in the history of our elections. You will not see a more bizarre commercial in all of American history than what they're running. I could not make this up. This is on TV in Ohio. I don't know if you guys have seen it. You can see it on YouTube. Is a commercial blaming the Chinese government for putting this referendum repeal on the ballot. And they've got the Chinese Congress. They've got goose-stepping Chinese, military. They've got the head of China. I mean, it is really, it's right out of the Cold War. It is really bizarre. And they are running this commercial in Ohio, urging people not to sign the petition to get the thing on the ballot, because the Chinese government are trying to subvert our nuclear power plants. I mean, God, these guys must be on acid. So what's going to happen now is that in the November election in 2020, there will be this ballot initiative that's going to bring out a lot of progressive voters. And, it's interesting, the unions have been supporting the bailout. And you'll love this, guys, John and Steve. This is right up our alley. There are a couple thousand union workers between the two reactors. And they lined up the unions, and the unions showed up at the state legislature, save our jobs. We actually had a union guy start crying in front of one of the committees. Don't close our nuclear plants. And the day less than 24 hours after the ballot initiative was after the bailout was passed by Ohio legislature, First Energy canceled their union contract at Perry. They didn't even wait 24 hours. Once they got the vote from the Ohio legislature, they canceled their union contract at Perry. For some reason, they left it intact at Davis-Besse. So I don't know what they're thinking. I guess they assumed there was not going to be a ballot initiative. So this is going to be a tricky one for the Democratic nominee. Joe Biden won't figure it out, but Bernie or Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris, they're going to have to walk a narrow path here, because the vote in Ohio is going to be overwhelming. I'm going to say 60-65% to reverse this bailout. You're talking $150 million a year. And not only are they bailing out two nuclear plants, they want to bail out two coal plants, and one of them is in Indiana, for God's sakes. I mean, you know, that's what's going to happen. This could be a major factor. And, Steve, you'll remember when we were working in Ohio that the Republicans in 2004 put on the ballot an initiative to ban gay marriage on the presumption they would bring out the right-wing Republicans or evangelicals. I assume it worked for them. But this time, the environmental movement, we have this, repeal on the ballot, which is supported, the repeal is supported by all the major newspapers in Ohio and by the oil and gas industry. So this is going to be a factor. This could be a route for whoever the Democrats nominate, as long, pray God, as it's not Joe Biden, to actually win Ohio. So, of course, they're stripping the voter rolls, as we see. But this is something to pay attention to. It's the first rise we've gotten that could actually flip Ohio to the Democrats. So we'll see how that goes. And now, let's get down to business here with you guys. I want to talk first about the North Carolina decision, the court decision, and the repeal of the gerrymandered districts there. John, both of you guys, we'll start with John. You spent a lot of time in North Carolina. Can you tell us what's going on with this court decision and how you think it's going to impact the election?
Well, I think it's an incredibly great thing that happened. A lot of the win was built on this guy, Thomas Hoffler, who died about a year ago, and his daughter, Stephanie, 3 months after he died, found out that he was dead, got with her mother, got into the files, and turned over hard drives and had all the evidence that showed the maps, the lies, the deception, the tricks. I mean, it is just like possibly a tipping point when it comes to gerrymandering. And there's no doubt that anybody who knows more about gerrymandering is, our good friend Steve Rosenfeld, which I want to say, Steve, wow, what a job in Iowa, what you've done, asking the right questions. And if people haven't read his book, Democracy Betrayed, it is about the 2016 election. It is about gerrymandering, how this country is really rigged. But it's also, at the end of his book, he gets into the fact of how we can make a difference. And Steve, what you did in Iowa by pushing so hard, asking the right questions, is that, I just can't say thank you enough.
Well, that's kind of you. You're welcome.
There is you.
Yes. Yeah, likewise here. So we're going to get to that. We're going to talk about Iowa in a minute. But let's talk about this North Carolina decision. Steve, I'm sure you followed it. Tell us about the substance of what now happens, that the gerrymandered maps in North Carolina have been thrown out. And is there a chance, by the way, that this could happen in other states now? I mean, Ohio, which is 50-50 blue-red, the congressional delegation is 12-4 Republican. Can this swing over there?
Well, I wish decisions like this, which not only involve the courts, but also involve political parties accepting the court's judgments, would have come earlier or sooner, in the election cycle. Because what I've been reading online, and this is from these election law blogs, is that time is really, really short if there's going to be redrawn districts for 2020. And what that means is that what you've got is you've got to basically draw the line soon enough so that candidates who are running can file for the elections in the right districts. And it's not a fast process. And basically what I'm afraid is going to happen is the Republicans kind of folded at the last minute because they know that the clock has run out, and they basically know that there's going to be a census in 2020. So they more or less have, you know, they sort of like surrendered the battle, but they've won the war. The war being, you know, what they've done to sort of take a purple state red and dominate it for the last decade. And, you know, when you ask about Ohio, I think it's much like the same thing because, it's, you know, we're not just thinking about the November election. We're talking about the primaries. And those are coming, in March, you know, or early, you know, early winter, you know, midwinter rather. So it's, and it's not just presidential primaries. It's all the state and local. So that's why I wish I could be more optimistic about this stuff.
Well, what's going to happen in North Carolina? Somebody's going to redraw the.
It's not clear.
The district
map.
It's
not clear. I mean, I'm reading these law blogs today, and people are speculating. And, you know, I mean, you would think that somebody would, the somebody being legislative committees. But the thing is, there's a history where legislatures go back and they redraw lines, and they're basically not very much better than what was there beforehand, and they fight about it again. And then and 2 years later, 3 years later, they're back at the same process, and they fight about it again. That was the case in Alabama. And, you know, your listeners should just know, you know, how big a difference does gerrymandering make? It, you know, what gerrymandering segregates voters. They look to the years where, like, what each party has done the worst. So with this past decade's gerrymandering, they looked at the McCain voters in 2008, the year Obama won the presidency by a 10 million popular vote margin. And they take those people who turned out and voted Republican, and they consider them the most reliable voters, and they draw lines or boundaries so that they'll reliably get something like a 55, 56, 57% voter turnout. And then they basically pack the Democrats into districts where they will typically win with closer to 70%. So when you have gerrymandered districts, you have like a 6 to 8% starting line advantage. And then you add voter ID, another 2 or 3%. You know, these are the other barriers. So literally you got a 10%, you know, head start with likely turnout. And that's what this is all about. And so that's really, you know, that's why it matters.
Well, so what is the mechanics now? There's no, the court has thrown out the districts in North Carolina, right? So technically now, going towards 2020, we have no congressional or state districts. Is that right? Or is it, did the court just throw out the state districts, or is it congressional as well?
It's the state's 13 congressional districts. And
okay, so it's federal then. It's the federal.
No, excuse me. It's the state court ruled that the state's legislative districts were a partisan gerrymander. And, you know, if they're a partisan gerrymander, then the same thing is also true about, you know, the congressional districts, because they were all redrawn at the same time. So it's just the thing that I'm reading the most is that it's not clear there's enough time to redraw these all before 2020, even though some people may try. And, you know, the North Carolina legislature is supposed to do it with their state districts, but whether they will or won't, it's not 100% clear to me. And I wish I could be more optimistic, but I'm reading what the people who really know this stuff and have been in all these lawsuits are saying online. So I wish I could be more clear, but I can't.
John Brakey, what do you know about North Carolina?
Well, I agree with Steve, but the people who don't know what they're talking about are thinking, yeah, we're going to hire an independent, and he's going to draw new maps, and we're going to get this thing done, and that would be nice. But the reality is, that's not going to happen. It's going to go into litigation. They're going to fight this thing out all the way, okay? Because that's the only way they can win. Is by playing this game. On a statewide, the governor won by, I think, 2 to 4 points, but he lost his House and Senate. They went in, stripped his power, led into many lawsuits, and now all of this is being exposed because this guy, this lady, daughter, turned over all these computer files, and a lot of this is all coming out, and it's going to get real interesting as more of this comes out.
Well, who has the power?
who has the power now to decide what districts they're going to use in the coming election?
That's an interesting question. You know, I've been in now 3 months, most have spent half my time there. I'm going back next Wednesday. And I find that really there's maybe three political powers going on there, you know, parties. It's Democrats, Republicans, and people of color. It's a very racist state. It has still a lot of problems. This whole thing with Trump has aggravated even more. Special interests, just like the story you told about the nuclear power plants. I could go in about monopolies, people who control voting there, who may work in 30 states, that they hire lobbyists and tell people that, you know, voting on paper ballots is something we used to do in the 1930s. But nowadays, what we need to do is spend $4,500 on a machine that marks something inside the machine, supposedly. And then they say it produces a ballot, but it produces a bunch of barcodes with some labels below that feed into it. And that if a county like Mecklenburg was to go with these equipment, which they want to go, they could spend $2 million for digital scanners, hand-marked paper ballots, and not have any long lines. But most likely, they're going to spend $9 million because $7 million is going to be spent on a machine that marks the ballot for you. And then when you look closely, it's not a ballot. A ballot has choices. This thing is bark. I mean, this is really insanity. And now on a state level, we fought there. We had our two of the Democrats with us real solidly and fought really hard. And then a new person comes in and says, hey, you know, barcodes they use at food stores. I think we should be able to use it in voting. And he ignores all the science. He comes in, insults all these top activists in elections in the state, including Common Cause, the League of Women Voters. It's really a mess, but it's a good fight going on, and now we're getting ready to take it to the county level because the counties are people who have to pay for this stuff.
Yeah, well, it's insane. Really insane. And, so we don't have a clear question here on North Carolina. And we're talking about 13 congressional seats.
Yes.
What is it now? 10-3?
Yeah, so
is it 10-3 now?
Yeah, so what it is, this was a decision in a state court decision. And so that means that the legislature has been ordered to redraw these maps. Now, you know, they're a red supermajority legislature, and whether they will do that or not, you know, basically flout the will of a state court is an open question. The next open question is, well, because the state ruled the way that court ruled the way that it did, one would think that you could also invalidate the congressional maps. But the question of whether to go back into court with a lawsuit to push that point is also one that, you know, it's not resolved. That's before the Democrats. Again, whether or not they should do it, it's not resolved. The timing that they could do it is also an issue. So that's why it's like the big picture here is, you know, the redistricting happens every 10 years. It happens after the census. The next census is next year. So really, you know, strategically, the Republicans have more or less sort of surrendered, you know, this battle, maybe. But basically, they've run up out the clock, and they've won the war for the last decade. You know, how it plays out at this finish line is kind of unclear, you know, both for the state and for, you know, these congressional seats. But, you know, real power is at stake. And I've never seen the Republicans willingly, you know, let go of power. And they have it now.
Did the court not say who will redraw the...
They said the legislature. They said the legislature. I'm reading
the legislature.
The legislature is ordered to do it without any partisan considerations and election results shall not be used in the drawing of the remedial maps. But when will they do this? And who's to say that? You get these fictions where people say, well, they make up all kinds of rationales that really are meaningless, and then the clock gets run out. This is just the same like presidential recounts. You know, you start a process that can't get across the finish line. You know, and so again, it's confusing. I'm just sort of saying this is realistic. It, you know, obviously it bears watching, but what may happen is it's by no means a slam dunk.
God, you know, I mean, I love to see the same thing in Ohio, and of course the brain-dead Democratic Party in Ohio, where you have a 50-50 state with 12 Republican congresspeople and 4 Democrats and supermajorities in both houses of Congress. They didn't go to did they go to the courts and challenge that gerrymandered setup? Will they now? Do we have any pulse here from the Democrats?
You know, I don't know. You know, it's interesting you said that because the action that's happened in North Carolina was led by Common Cause. They're the ones who, and also the NAACP. I don't know where the Democrats fit into it. I haven't really followed it that close on that level. They're not good with the grassroots anymore, okay? I mean, you know, I worked with the Democratic Party for years. I'm still a Democrat, okay? But, you know, the Democratic Party is known to be a little too political, back bad candidates, and then put, you know, weed killer on their grassroots, you know, put it bluntly.
There you go, yeah. Glyphosate on the grass, you know, Agent Orange
on
the grassroots.
Yeah, exactly.
Applied by the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just an abomination watching these guys, and especially Joe Biden. I got to say, there's a reporter from New York Times, Mark Leibovich, who's actually the stepson of one of my childhood friends, and I've met him. And he wrote a piece. He interviewed Biden. And the thing basically was, why are you running? And, you know, Biden basically had no answer. You know, he's got this idea that he could help defeat Trump. But if you read the thing closely, I mean, you almost hear Biden saying that he would desperately like to get out of the race. You know, I mean, he should be sitting on a park bench feeding pigeons, for God's sakes. And so, you know, once again, the major problem we face is the corporate Democrats and their just complete unwillingness, inability to do anything for the general welfare. Steve, now you, let's get to Iowa. You have been writing about and are involved in the structure of the upcoming Democratic primaries. Tell us about what's going on.
Well, what's going on is the Democrats coming out of 2016 were split. Obviously, you know, there were big wounds and ill feelings between the Hillary camp and the Bernie camp. So they had a unity reform commission to try to, you know, heal matters. And among the things that were recommended was that the states that are going to have caucuses, which are just a few because the number has really shrunk, would have to offer some kind of absentee balloting or you know, not physically present option for people. So in last December, there's a rules committee at the Democratic National Committee, which sort of oversees the you know, just the way that all the delegates are basically elected and allocated and the people who show up at the national convention to nominate the president. So basically they have to review every state's plans, and they had in their rules a requirement that states that are having these caucuses should offer an online voting option. And so what's happened is I've been covering that because they put a bunch of things in the rules, like an online voting option, a paper trail, you know, being able to have full audits. These things don't all add up. They're good words in policy circles, or maybe they're not good words, but they're basically ideas that don't get matched by, you know, the reality of building such a system on the ground. So I started covering all this, and what's ended up happening is last week, or coming out of the late August meeting of the DNC in San Francisco, the tech staff basically said you can't build one of these systems, a virtual voting system in Iowa or Nevada, and they were pretty similar. Nevada's the third caucus, Iowa's first. That would be safe and reliable. So it's a pretty big turnaround because, you know, what happens with these are like slow-moving ships, and they're hard to change. It's hard to change course, and but they did. And you know, I've been told that a lot of the articles that I have written, you know, helped actually sort of like frame the discussion that happened behind closed doors. So what it means is that largely the the Iowa caucus, the Nevada caucuses will pretty much be like they were in 2016. They might have some kind of an early voting option, which could be like dropping off some kind of like an absentee ballot. They have to work that out because New Hampshire doesn't want it to seem too much like a primary. And what makes it a primary is having a ballot as opposed to a caucus, which is a physically present sort of it's like a straw poll. So all that has to be worked out. There's going to be a meeting tomorrow. But for the most part,
what meeting?
Oh, the Rules Committee is going to meet to figure out finally, you know, what's up. But and they're doing it by phone. But basically, they're stopping themselves from having what would otherwise be a potentially tremendously embarrassing situation, because they were going to try to unroll or unveil or debut a completely untested new system. And it doesn't mean just like it means the registration, it means the outreach, it means the, you know, the login, the PIN numbers by email, the counting, the apps that, you know, caucus chairs were going to have. All of this was going to be through rented systems from vendors.
Okay.
None of this has been used before. And they basically, you know, the DNC tech staff said, hey, I mean, they talked about cybersecurity, which is sort of like the safe buzzword to hide behind. But really, the truth is they weren't ready for prime time because they didn't have a complete system they could even look at to evaluate. And, you know, to their credit, I mean, this, you know, we talk, it's easy to bash on Democrats, but there are different kinds of Democrats and that I've observed in this process. And, you know, there are people at the top of the party like Tom Perez who was issuing these statements saying we're going to do this online voting thing. It's going to be great. You know, everybody get in line. Well, he was pushed back. And you had the heads of these rules committees, the rules committee who were there, you know, these are not young 20-somethings, they're people who have been in campaigns for decades. They actually, to their credit, responded to facts and precedent. And they said, you know what, we gave these Iowa and Nevada months and months to pull it together. They didn't do it. We got to pull the plug. So, you know, I wish, you know, more public officials would be receptive to facts. I mean, this is what, you know, John is fighting in North Carolina. You know, they present all the facts about these voting systems, and somebody comes in and just rams something through on behalf of a contractor. So that's what's going on. It's probably something that people...
Well, you know, I personally met Tom Perez, and I handed him a copy of our book, The Strip and Flip Disaster of America's Stolen Elections. And he looked at me like I just handed him a piece of toilet paper.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've gotten zero response from these people. You know, it's pathetic.
Well, I think I got lucky, you know, in a certain sense. I think I was very fortunate that, you know, I started early and I happened to pick an issue that other people weren't covering and I wasn't alarmist. I just laid out, you know, what was really happening with others. First, I laid out what happened when the Republicans tried this and what went wrong. Then I laid out ways that these kinds of voting systems have been hijacked or sabotaged, you know, in Canada where they've been used. I laid out things that can go wrong that have nothing to do with Russia, but have everything to do with people being unfamiliar with how to use new systems. And, you know, it was persuasive.
John Brakey?
It's phenomenal what he did, because I was watching it all the way through, very concerned. You know, people need to realize that primaries are more important than general elections. Primaries is where they set the deck chairs on the Titanic, okay, and shift things that it's their right hand and their left hand. And that's why what we do and what Stephen just did is being proactive and being there and letting people know, like what we're doing in North Carolina, you know, trying to make the state 100% paper ballots. And, you know, and when we go in and meet these people, we're not there to talk about how much we as talk as conspiracy theorists, where they're talking and saying, hey, we want to prove to the American people elections are real because the cynicism in this country is becoming very damaging. 44% of the people in this country in a presidential election in 2016 did not vote. If not voting was a presidential candidate, they won by a landslide. I mean, my God, you take a look. What did Hillary get? 27%? Trump got 26. If you look at the real numbers, hey, a guy in 1932 did better. He got 34%. And that's where our democracy's in trouble, because we don't make elections transparent, trackable, and publicly verified. This 44% of the people who don't vote, I think they belong to the Mark Twain party. You know, what was it? Mark Twain said over 100 years ago, if voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. It's a serious problem. And we need to prove to the American people that their vote really matters. And we know how to do that. We're going to make elections transparent, trackable, publicly verified. In the presidential election, maybe 75 to 80% of all votes cast will be cast on by hand-marked paper ballots. And those hand-marked paper ballots go into a digital scanner that creates an exact copy front and back. Folks, that's a public record. And, you know, what we're trying to do is to give the system a tetanus shot. A tetanus shot against hackers, okay? And we know that hackers only steal if they have impunity. They make it very hard to get the paper ballots, okay? And then, of course, with these digital images, I'm running around the country with my lawyers and saying, Your Honor, could you please order these people to follow the law? They cannot destroy this stuff. It's what the system counted. It's in the chain of custody. And, of course, the system tries to say, oh, you didn't dot your I, cross your T, start all over again. But, hey, we're in the fight, and we're waking people up. And the more people who know this, who can join in and do, you'd be surprised with just a few people getting together, going to a Board of Elections meeting. You know, I'm hanging real hard with the NAACP. I love them. These are my brothers. And, you know, they appreciate my passion because they have the same passion and to see the problems that we see. But, you know, one of them, I was doing a forum with, he stood up and he was talking and he says, you know, I'm on the third largest board in the state of elections. And, you know, I, on the Board of Elections and, you know, I make a decision. And then a week later, people come and go, Dr. Spearman, how could you have made that decision? And you know what he said? He's so right, because you weren't here to get me informed. These people are being guided by the vendors, not by us. We need to get in front of these boards, you know. Well, and that's what
let's
we're doing
talk about.
In
let's
North
talk
Carolina.
About these. What's that, Steve? Steve?
Yeah.
What did you say about North Carolina?
Well, you know what's happening. You know, North Carolina is a remarkable place for John, and these fellow advocates to make a stand. North Carolina had the most progressive voting laws in the South before 2010. They really did. They registered high school students before they turned 18. They had all kinds of early voting. They had same day registration. For a Southern state, they were, you know, more liberal in some ways than New York and California at the time. And when the Republicans came in, what happened was they targeted local races in 2010, you know, with a backlash against Obama, and that's how they won the majority in the legislature to do the gerrymandering. And then when they redrew those maps, as soon as they had that supermajority, they started passing all this really regressive laws, like voter ID laws, you know, and all this other stuff. They started repealing early voting options and just, you know, everything that's in the South, you know, party and race are synonymous. And you have these legal fictions where you're not allowed to do racially discriminatory, election law changes, but you are allowed to do partisan, you know, power plays, and this is what the Supreme Court has upheld. And, you know, it's a complete fiction that there's a difference between party and race when it comes to, you know, the South. So, so it's against this backdrop that, you have you know, this sort of like upsurge in activism, you know, led by, groups, you know, Reverend William Barber is the head of the NAACP. And, you know, he spoke at the Democratic DNC meeting in San Francisco about a week and a half ago. He gave a better speech than every single presidential candidate about the moral imperatives, you know, and facing this country in this election. It was astounding. And it's that kind of leadership that's there, and it's on the upsurge. And what John is fighting about, and this is sort of the same stuff I was covering, you know, with the Democrats, you know, in Iowa and Nevada and these other caucuses and primaries, is, you know, what's the finish line going to look like so we can actually trust the results? Because, you know, if these elections didn't matter, things wouldn't, and voting didn't matter, believe me, things would not be so murky. You know, real power exists, and it's really at stake. And to think otherwise and to be apathetic and throw up your hands is completely nuts, because look at what people are doing who have the power. And it's not just at the federal level. So, you know, so John goes in there and they're trying to buy new voting machines, and these voting machines are going to be around for a decade, and they're going to provide an evidence trail or the absence of one, you know, that will be used, you know, to decide really close elections. You know, so that's what the stakes are here. And, you know, and the people who are there in North Carolina, you know, the activist base, you know, they don't need to be told any of this stuff, because, you know, they've been living it and fighting with it for years. And it's real. You know, it's not made up. And but, you know, you come to these decision points, and they're approaching one there. And, you know, what John has seen is that basically Democrats who, you know, it's a split state. The legislature is a red supermajority. The governor is a Democrat. You know, you're not exactly having all the Democrats, you know, acting in unison. You've got some who are more in the thralls of the voting vendors, and you have others who are more aligned with citizens and citizens groups and a more transparent process. And it's messy, and in a more perfect world, it shouldn't be, but it is what it is.
So let's say here we're getting close to the end here. Steve Rosenfeld and John Brakey, tell us what's going on with these ballot marking devices, and who is which states are lining up for this ridiculous scam here, and what we got to deal with it, John. The millions of dollars they want to blow on this.
It is outrageous. I mean, it comes down to, let's say, for example, a county like Guilford, which is where the president of the NAACP sits on a board, is that they can go ahead and have a system that counts hand-marked paper ballots for 1.5 million, or they can go with these machines, okay, by ESNS, and that will cost $6,400,000 at the time they get done putting this kind of a system in. And it's ridiculous. These machines, it's compliant for the disability community, okay? They say that it's going to be cheaper over time. I mean, when you vote on this thing, it's like a push and pray machine. It's a DRE that now they call a ballot marking device. Instead of that cheap piece of paper, they now have a piece of tougher card paper. And by the way, that piece of paper that they're going to save is going to save a lot of money over it. Ballots cost 12 cents each, okay? They're going to make a bundle on that. The machine, over a 10-year period, you'll have to pay $70 a year for licensing. The machine costs $3,500, okay? And only 120 people, if you, in a 12-hour day, realistically could vote on this machine if they don't take more than 6 minutes each, okay? And it's a long line producer. The information it puts out when it feeds into the other machine, it doesn't read the selection. It says that you voted. It reads a barcode, okay? Do you read barcode? I mean, it violates the chain of custody. We want hand-marked paper ballots everywhere. The reason for it is because they're hand-marked. And if there's multiple races on these hand-marked paper ballots, they become a snowflake-type ballot. Makes it very hard to forge. You know, everybody, you know, if you know what happened with Volkswagen, how they passed emissions in this state 2 million times with a rigged computer in that diesel car. Well, this is the same thing in our voting machines. They could be running logic and accuracy tests, which is the same thing as an emission test, and saying everything is working fine while it's cheating by 40 to 80% over the limit. I mean, these are the, that's why we have to have hand-marked paper ballots, because it's practical, it's auditable, and it's unique. Going into a machine
who is
very capable of doing a great job, but it may not. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What states specifically are looking to buy these machines?
Well,
Georgia. Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
Georgia just bought a system by Dominion, which is another it's another one of the handful of big manufacturers. And South Carolina is lining up to buy ones by ES&S, the ones that I was talking about in North Carolina. New Jersey, Delaware just went with ES&S. And then there's a whole bunch of counties, and these are big counties, like Philadelphia, around Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Texas, Kentucky, Indiana, Kansas, some in California, and some in New York State. And the big issue here is what is a ballot is being redefined. And the reason that, you know, people are so, you know, people like John and people like me, you know, say that you know, everything starts around hand-marked, not machine-marked, paper, is there is no better record of voter intent. It's just indisputable because nothing else stands between the voter and the record, you know, which they mark by themselves. As soon as you insert other layers of technology, things can go awry or get amiss. That doesn't mean, by the way, that paper is 100% perfect. It's not. You know, people can steal paper ballots. People can fill in empty races. People can lose them. They can become a big management headache when you have, like, a million people in a jurisdiction. But it doesn't matter. There's no better, you know, initial fundamental record. And then, you know, if you want to use computers, you know, to sort through these things and do scans and multiple scans and cross-checking and double-checking, you can do all that. But because basically the fundamental underlying record is something that can't be hacked and can be directly traced, you know, to, you know, it could be anonymous, but still marked by a voter. So that's what it's all about. So what you have is you have the industry that makes voting machines come in and say, well, no, paper's really messy, and you election officials, you know what a drag it is to handle all the paper, so we'll do something different. We'll print out, you know, a ballot summary card. It'll be smaller. It'll be scanned. You know, there won't be any worry about, you know, misinterpreting or fighting over, like, a sloppy mark, because some people don't fill in ovals. They make X's, or they do circles, or they, you know, whatever they do. And it's a way to sort of, you know, make things go fast and easy and tidy at the end. So a lot of election officials have really bought into this. It just also so happens that a lot of these folks, election officials, have been lobbied for years by a handful of, you know, private vendors. And, you know, and what happens is, you know, they make a pile of money when they sell these voting systems, and they have to keep making a lot of money to, you know, to stay in business. And the way they do that is they have all these annual licensing fees and contracts and maintenance and this and that and the other. And it's just a, you know, it's a handout for these companies. It's a way for a lot of officials to, you know, to sort of get off the hook and not face, you know, like a tight recount at, you know, at the end of a long season. But the people who end up losing in this whole scenario is the public, because you end up with these systems that they can't trust, and they can't trust them because, they, you know, seeing is not believing. Who can read a barcode? And so there you go.
It's unbelievable. It's like these guys are doing everything they possibly can to avoid having an easy vote count and a clean vote count.
Well, I mean, you know, it may not be so easy necessarily.
This is pure corruption, right?
It may not be so easy to, like, you know, count a million paper ballots, you know, in some of these big counties. But if you want a believable process, you know, it, you know, that's you know, we don't live in a perfect world. What it comes down to is you have to really make these risk assessments at key points and at steps in the process and decide what's the best choice at that particular juncture. And, you know, these ballot marking devices are not the best choice when it comes to a record for recounts in close elections. They're not the best choice when it comes to, you know, spending taxpayer money wisely. You know, they're not the best choice for a lot of reasons. And, you know, because you don't have because we don't have government-run elections, we don't have voting systems that are developed, you know, by some, you know, non-private profit-making entity like other countries do, we're sort of
mind-boggling.
Limited menu.
It's mind-boggling. We're almost done here. Steve Rosenfeld, how do people get a hold of you and your book?
Well, I'm at the Independent Media Institute. Well, my pieces are published in a half dozen more, you know, websites online. You can just go there; they're linked to it. So that's where I am.
John Brakey.
You can reach me by email, johnbrakey@gmail.com. My website is auditelectionsusa.org. I'm on Facebook as Audit USA too, and as John Roberts Brakey. You'll find what we're doing. We're very active in many states and always looking to connect with new people and teach them how to be a very good election scrutineer, because that's what I've turned into. I scrutinize elections. You can Google that word. It means just what it says. Thank you.
Scrutineer. I like it. Well, before we go, I want to congratulate the San Francisco Board of Supervisors has just unanimously resolved to declare the National Rifle Association as, quote, a domestic terrorist organization. So let's applaud that one. It's astounding.
And also, you know what they did is that the election board there in the 2020 election is going to release right away all the ballot images by precinct proving that their election was honest.
Well, let's get that spread nationwide. I mean, I'm still staggered by the level of corruption and the brain dead nature of the Democratic Party. We still got to deal with this. I do also want to say that I was disappointed. This guy, Andrew Yang, I think it is, who's supporting the $1,000 handout for all Americans, is now supporting nuclear power, which is ridiculous. And Cory Booker also. So he's off my list. At least Kamala Harris question what we're going to do with nuclear waste. And, of course, Bernie remains opposed to nuclear power. You guys are still great. We'll continue to have you on. Congratulations, Steve, on your unique contribution here in Ohio. We'll see you next week in Solartopia. Thank you, guys.
Did we
Thank you.
From what we conceived. Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.